Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. We're doing a pre-recording today with one of our favorite guests, brilliant scholar and a professor of history at Duke University. Recently, we rebroadcast one of our 2017 interviews with Nancy McLean. We did so because we thought it was one of the best things we had done. So we had 5 weeks during the early days of the virus where we picked shows back over the whole, gosh, as we've been broadcasting since 2011, over the whole period. And when we picked Nancy McLean's show as one, she wrote a beautiful and brilliant book called Democracy in Chains. Are you there, Nancy?
I am. It's great to be with you again. It's been a minute.
Yeah, it's been a while. Now, when I was getting ready for the show, I went on the internet, or the internet, as I call it sometimes. And what struck me again, and what struck me when we first did the show, but what struck me again in looking on the internet is you say that you stirred up a hornet's nest. To me, it's like you pulled back the curtain on an aspect of the whole libertarian Koch brothers movement and its historical and intellectual basis that nobody had ever seen before, and it just incited absolute fury.
Yes, they were very angry, and I think one aspect of this, there were two aspects really. One is that it's a very ingrown cause where people share the same assumptions, they reinforce one another's assumptions. They see the world in the same way. And this was really, I think, the first book that came and looked at this cause from somebody, it's the point of view of those of us who don't share their assumptions. And what I saw didn't look very flattering and was frightening to most people. And so I think it was a real shock to them to see what they look like to the rest of us, you know, and what we can hear in their words as we try to make sense of what they've done to our country. So that was one thing that I think upset them. Another thing was that they have built, through the Koch donor network, funded by Charles Koch and, you know, embedded by these other people. We've all heard a lot about their political spending, but they have also implanted these centers at universities around the country. And I wrote about the flagship one, George Mason University in Virginia. But, of course, they're everywhere now. Arizona has a big such Koch, I call them implants, at Arizona State University, another at the University of Arizona. I think they're also trying to get into Northern Arizona University. And these supposedly academic outposts are really political bodies that are serving the Koch cause. And so I think that was another thing that really, really upset them and scared them, was to have someone expose their academic investments as being really part of the self-serving political project. Then the other thing that was pretty funny that I didn't know when I published, but was that they were going to start, just about to launch, a huge multi-million dollar fundraising campaign at George Mason University in the name of this figure about whom I wrote, Nobel Prize winning economist named James McGill Buchanan. So for a whole number of reasons, they were just, you know, incensed to have their cause exposed, really, frankly, for what it is. It was kind of a wild ride. But I think of them now as gnats, you know, and the most important finding of my book is that the Koch network and this big libertarian apparatus is trying to rig our politics because they understand that permanent ideological minority, and people don't want to live in the world they're trying to create, and that's why they have to do what they do, and to have that exposed was really troublesome for them, we could say.
One of the things they do that strikes me is that they campaign, and I get the, there's a big libertarian institute here in Arizona, for some reason, I guess because of Rabidi or something, I get their regular broadcast, and I mean all their emails. One of the things is they cut the spending to public universities, and then they turn around and set up centers that they control.
Yes.
It's a combination. It's not an accident that they're reducing public spending. I think one of the most, I think we can say is one of the most destructive ideologies of the country. It seems very mild-mannered. It sounds good at first. Is this libertarianism, because it systematically breaks down the connection between people and the public space. It reduces public ownership of anything. I think, Gary, have you joined us on the show, Gary LeMaster?
I have.
And you're a fan of Nancy's book, I know.
I'm a big fan. I've recommended it to as many people as I can.
And
thank you so much, Gary.
Yeah. And
you're welcome.
Yeah. I think, Steve, what you were just saying, in fact, this COVID crisis that we're living through now, this catastrophe in public health in America, is really something that should be viewed through the lens of what I talked about in Democracy in Chains, in that from this libertarian right, we have had for six decades now, you know, this continual attack on government, on the legitimacy of government, on the character of public actors, whether they're elected officials or union union people or civil rights activists or environmentalists or whatever, this really, really toxic set of ideas about democracy. But we have also had the Koch donor network, through its control at this point of the Republican Party and of all these different organizations, actually mortally wound government so that it cannot be responsive in the way that it should to this crisis. And that is why the U.S. now leads the world in deaths from COVID-19. You know, we know it's about 100,000 now as we're talking. And, you know, we could just go chapter and verse about the way in which the Koch network and its operations have helped. You know, certainly they didn't cause the virus, but they have so hamstrung government and poisoned the atmosphere of public debate, as we see in these reopen protests, and the, you know, fact that wearing masks has now become some kind of like a culture war fight, you know, all of this can be traced to the power of these billionaire donors who know that they cannot get what they want by saying it honestly in public. So instead, they rig the rules of government, suppressing the vote, gerrymandering, you know, doing all these other things, and they poison the public conversation through the organizations that they fund and these university and college outposts that we were talking about, and also through their alliance with the likes of Fox Broadcasting, Breitbart, and so forth.
The what I see is that they've done that's really terrible is they've crippled the ability of government. We're talking about public health issues, folks. We're not talking about, you know, the Defense Department or something like that. That's another issue. But they've reduced the ability. So the American health system, the CDC was the premier public health organization in the world. All these things have been underfunded now for decades, underappreciated, and demoted in terms of their influence. And so when the virus hit, we had weakened all the elements and areas of government that we needed to protect us. And I think that's clear that from your book, that this is a systematic, long-term process. They really don't believe in government. When the libertarians talk about freedom, and I get their letters, they're talking about commercial freedom. They're talking about business freedom, and they want to be free of regulations like environmental regulations. They want to be free of to discriminate against people. They want to be free to have their businesses run without oversight, without government inspection. They don't want their meatpacking plants inspected, you know, so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. That's their idea of freedom. It strikes me. I don't know if you agree.
Absolutely true. It's freedom for them, and particularly people of property, and particularly people of exceedingly large amounts of property, like millionaires, to have the freedom to do what they want to do and to have total autonomy and let the rest of us deal with it. So they actually, their view of government, the libertarian view of government, people need to understand, is that government has only three legitimate functions. That is to provide for the national defense, to ensure the rule of law, and to guarantee social order. So in short form, armies, courts, and police. That's all they think government should be doing. So these are the people who for decades have been going after Social Security, claiming they're going to reform it, when actually what they're trying to do is privatize it and drive us to individual accounts. They've gone after Medicare. They've tried everything they can do to stop the Medicaid expansion of the Affordable Care Act. They're trying to undermine public education. I mean, you mentioned earlier the Libertarian Institute's big one in Arizona, which is, of course, the Goldwater Institute. So all of these elements of the agenda are designed over time to push us to that form of government that is only armies, courts, and police, which is something that no Americans would want to live with, right? We, especially rural people, ironically, the people on whose votes they depend, rural people need their post office. You know, FedEx and UPS are never going to deliver mail to people in rural communities on anything like fair terms.
It's never going to be profitable, Nancy, to go out on these rural roads and
exactly.
deliver mail. They want to destroy the post office, which has been an American institution and a good one for what? Couple of hundred years.
But the post office is actually part of what made America great, right? I mean, it was the fact that rural people, and you can go back to the populist movement of the 1890s, actually the farmers who were part of that, they were some of the most sophisticated readers and thinkers and learning about the new science, not just of crops, but of everything. And they were able to do that because we had rural free delivery, right? We had a postal service. And that's just one example, too, I think, of how this agenda really for these organizations is much more about corporate supremacy than about freedom as most Americans would understand it. You know, freedom is also the freedom from, horrible domination by your boss, or, the freedom to try out your new idea, for a business, knowing that you're not going to go, lose everything, right? It's freedom to have security, some retirement security through Social Security so that you don't have to move in with your kids, as used to be the case. There's just so many ways in which most of us understand freedom as a kind of freedom from domination and a freedom to, experiment, to have fresh ideas, et cetera, whereas, as you pointed out, for this corporate libertarian cause, it's really freedom for them to pollute, freedom for them to discriminate, freedom for them not to provide adequate PPE, and health and safety for their employees in this crisis, yet to insist that they go back to work, and to refuse to pay unemployment compensation if people don't come back to work. So it's really something that Americans need to understand in order to actually reclaim our country from the people who are driving it over the cliff.
Do you think that people understand that when they want to pollute, they want to go ahead and they don't want any pollution measures, they want to go ahead and pollute, that they really are externalizing the cost of the pollution on the American taxpayers, the American people? The cleaning up of these poisoned rivers is still got to be done, and it ends up being us picking up the tab. Superfund sites, partially funded by so many of the companies that that caused the Superfund sites suddenly disappeared when it was time to clean them up. So there's this long process. Gary, what do you see? Do you see anything new since we talked to Nancy last in terms of what the libertarian right wing, I guess I call them corporate libertarians rather than individualist libertarians. Mm-hmm. Gary, what do you see?
I have a couple of questions, but I'd start out by saying that I think every once in a while the GOP, some people within it let the whole plan slip. When the Trump economic advisor speaks out and calls the people going to work, going back to work as human capital stock.
Let's slip that if there's
free and widespread voting, Republicans would never be elected again.
There have been some real revelations of that nature, since the book came out. And also that footage that surfaced of Paul Weyrich saying early on, who's, of course, one of the founders of the American Legislative Exchange Council and a real builder of the new right, but saying, "I don't want everybody to vote. It's not good for us if everybody votes. If everybody votes, we lose." So, there have been quite a few gaffes like that, or moments of honesty and candor, depending on how you want to put it, that have really shown what this cause is all about and why it's so important for the rest of us to understand it and also, frankly, to stop it.
So what we've been trying to emphasize a bit here on Democratic Perspective is there Trump, who you can argue about whether he's a sociopath or a narcissistic sociopath or all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You can see him do all the crazy stuff. But underneath that, something else is happening, which is the continuation under Donald Trump's presidency of the extreme anti-government measures, anti-controls of the environment and so forth and so on. There's all these things going on. And there's a reason that I think people, you have to watch whatever the show is and see what's going on and try to understand that. But you have to look at, I mean, I'm lecturing people, but take a look at what's being done sort of behind the scenes or just right out of sight. They're not even hiding it. They're just hoping you don't focus on that.
Well, frankly, they're also playing us. There was actually The Guardian had a report. I'm going to say it was maybe 6 months ago, but it was a Trump administration official at a private meeting of oil and gas executives. And he said, it is absolutely thrilling to be working for this administration. This president has such a knack for turning the attention of the people and the media elsewhere while we do our work. And that, I think, is what people are not getting to with the obsession with Trump, is that we're also being played in that, because under his administration, these corporate libertarians have run their agenda right through the country. So they've stocked the Supreme Court, of course, with justices like Brett Kavanaugh and like Neil Gorsuch, who want nothing more than to undermine the whole New Deal, on which millions of Americans depend, from Social Security to all of these other things we've been talking about. So they've also, Trump has put through seated more judges on the federal judiciary than any president in living memory. Now, he doesn't give a damn about the details of that. He outsourced it to one of the top Koch people, a guy named Donald McGahn, who's no longer in the administration but played a crucial role in those judicial appointments and works with the Federalist Society, which Koch also funded. So you have the judiciary in the EPA. The fossil fuel corporate libertarian agenda has gone through almost unobstructed. Trump's first act was to pull out of the Paris Climate Accords, and since then he's just essentially shredded environmental regulations in the interests of these donors and ideologues. So, I mean, you could just go right through, but while he is distracting us and actually goading liberals, I mean, he really knows how to get people attention elsewhere, as that guy said. So while we look at him and stew at him, they're pushing their agenda through. And so it's very frustrating to watch when you know what the real game is, kind of the quiet game. It's like a classic con almost.
They've weakened and in some ways destroyed and weakened American public health. The whole governmental thing. And then when the pandemic hit, they pumped all this money into the Defense Department, even more than the Defense Department even asked for. And then they underfunded. They cut all the spending that would have helped us deal with the COVID virus.
Yeah, well, another thing they're doing, too, and people probably should be paying attention to this, is they are determined not, and this is the donors and the, you know, libertarian organizations funded by Koch, you know, not just the administration and the kind of captured Republicans in the Senate, but they are determined not to help support states now that are going to be facing fiscal crises because they have, you know, most of them have these balanced budget requirements in their constitutions, and they're not getting revenue because so many people are unemployed and businesses down. So the only thing that they're going to be able to do is flesh cut, right? So they're going to be firing teachers. They're going to be firing firefighters. They're going to be firing police. They're going to have to do all of these things to trim their budgets. And the Republicans are trying to push that on, you know, doing the bidding of these donors, because remember, all they want is armies, courts, and police, right? So they think all these other things that state governments do, from public health to public education to maintaining parks and so forth, that's all superfluous and illegitimate. So it's a kind of right-wing social engineering to have Congress refuse to support the states in providing for these obvious needs now in this moment of crisis. Yeah, so we're really seeing, you know, again and again, the kind of systemic, shrewd rule rigging, that kind of strategy that I described in Democracy in Chains. It's just on steroids now in the Trump era.
The virus is hit hardest at the coastal states, California and New York, mm-hmm. New Jersey and stuff, that are Democratic states. I think that the Trump administration and his supporters really want to keep those states from recovering well by keeping the funds out. They are stopping any funds going to state government to help them recover, just as you're saying. They're doing mm-hmm. that not to save money, right? Because mm-hmm. they passed all these corporate tax cuts, the Trump administration
right.
did. And the new study shows that, well, it didn't do anything except, you know, make rich guys richer, which I guess was the whole idea, right, Gary?
Absolutely. I go back to the $4 trillion that came out of the tax cuts that went into stock buybacks, which artificially pumped up the stock markets. And mm-hmm. it's hurt the middle class and the poor, but it certainly helped out the wealthy. I'd be curious of your view of this. I think Trump is the perfect foil for the GOP, and I think he's much like Reagan, who I've always felt that most of the really bad stuff that's happened so far to the U.S. has happened under the Reagan administration. At least a lot of it started then. And under Trump, and I can't help but believe that Reagan was a little more than a paid actor, and that Trump is just a perfect foil who is able to keep people distracted while the others go about their real business.
Yeah,
Reagan had a long association with the, you know, the political right, the Republican right, and I think believed deeply in a lot of these things and got it, you know, at some level. Whereas Trump, you know, he has almost no attention span. You know, and that's the other thing they said. You know, he doesn't pay attention, so he wouldn't listen to the briefings. He gets, you know, he gets dumpy. He's, you know, he has attention deficit disorder, and he's our president, and so he wouldn't take in the briefings, and therefore can't act on things. But I think, and he's definitely not interested in programmatic details. I mean, he's essentially outsourced everything to other people while he focuses on the media and their impressions of him, you know, personally, and their framing of him, but or packaging of him. But I think another thing for us to realize is that one thing that links them together, this kind of, you know, the hard corporate libertarians and Donald Trump, is a kind of social Darwinism behind a lot of what they do, and long associated with this kind of orthodox libertarianism, is a social Darwinism that says, you know, if you're a billionaire, well, that's because you are superior, right? You are so special and so smart, and you were so shrewd, and you did so many great things, you have reaped your just rewards. Whereas, if you are a working class person, you know, who's struggling from paycheck to paycheck, who, you know, having trouble making house payments, health payments, that's on you. There's nothing in this system that is rigged against you. It's just the government has coddled you, right? And so you can see when you spoke of that and talking about human capital stock, you know, I honestly, it makes me sick to say it, but I think that they're probably pleased that people are dying. Some people are dying from this, right? That it's hitting communities of color more, African-Americans and Latinos, and also people of lesser income, and also older people in nursing homes. This libertarian cause, I think listeners need to understand, Americans need to understand, is flying under a false flag when they call themselves conservative. As I show in my book, when they were honest and told the truth in the 1970s, they called themselves radicals. They said they were radicals of the right. They spoke of revolution. They spoke of toppling the ruling class in America, etc. These people who want to, who are perfectly comfortable with essentially killing people in nursing homes, right? Or grandmas, grandpas, you know, older people. That's what this cause is. It is social Darwinism, because they see people who are older, who are not in the labor force, as having lesser value.
They're not productive. They're not productive.
Exactly.
I mean, I don't know if they...
language. Makers, takers, productive, parasites. I think it's hard for people who haven't studied these ideas and studied these movements to understand how toxic it is and how threatening to human life. I mean, it is literally a deadly dogma, and we are seeing that play out in our country now.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. I don't really know what they think. I do think that some of them are certainly, you know, they're looking at it, well, it's killing off a whole bunch of people in nursing home. Well, those people are not productive. We don't need them anyway. They're just collecting Social Security. I think there is a hard-heartedness that's almost beyond politics. I don't know how extensive it is, Nancy, and I don't know if people, if they admit it to themselves, that this is the logical result of policies that value only productivity and see productivity mm-hmm. only as what the top few innovators do. I don't know.
Well, but the Texas governor, too, you know, we saw this, and I agree with you. I think most people would not even acknowledge to themselves where these ideas are pulling them. But I think, you know, when the governor of Texas says, surely, you know, older people would be willing to sacrifice themselves, or to see some of them sacrifice to reopen the economy, you know, that's what he's saying. This is policy in a number of red states run by people who are associated, you know, with these ideas and with these donors. And, you know, and it's a false choice, right? Like, we know if people go back to work and they don't have proper protection, we're going to see a second spike of this thing. Whereas if you had people who were sane conservatives and sane, you know, I should say, you know what I mean, decent, frankly, they would be saying, okay, let's go back to work carefully, right, with masks and with, you know, proper rules, as is happening in many places. But, you know, in some of these states run by people, you know, in today's Republican Party, they're just going to reap the whirlwind. And many people are saying, and I think it's a reasonable assumption, that they're pushing for this because they don't want to pay unemployment to people to stay out until it's safe to go back. So people are being, you know, workers themselves are saying, you know, we're not essential, we're sacrificial. They're, you know, these people are risking our lives.
They want to cut the extra unemployment payments, and they don't want to pay. They don't want to pay unemployment. They want to go back to work, and if people die, they die. It's a very tough-minded kind of thing.
Yeah,
we can't really prevent this virus. It's not really hitting us. It's not really hitting mm-hmm. the young people, so therefore we can sort of do whatever we want to do. That's kind of a hard-heartedness.
I'm in that over 70 age group that's vulnerable, and my response to sacrifice as far as Trump is concerned is after you.
Yeah.
I'll follow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I will say, you know, because we could spend a long time on what's awful and frightening about all of this, and it is, but one thing that's been very encouraging to me since Democracy in Chains came out in 2017, in my travels around the country, speaking with groups and, you know, communities all over the place, including your own. Remember, you all brought me to Arizona. I had actually came to Arizona twice and had wonderful trips both times. But there has been so much organizing since then and so much recognition that this is a time of all hands on deck emergency for democracy. So I think it's important maybe that we recognize that as well, that many others, you know, while this cause continues to push and gets, if anything, more extreme and hysterical, the people on the, you know, progressive side have done really impressive work. I mean, the fact that Joe Biden's campaign believes that Arizona is likely to, you know, I think he said the most likely to switch into the Democratic camp with the 2016 election, that should be really encouraging to people. And the fact that your grassroots activists, that what was called Save Our Schools movement,
that
effort from the Goldwater Institute to lift the cap on public funding for private schools, you know, and around the country, everywhere that democracy reform has been on the ballot, you know, to fight voter suppression, to stop partisan gerrymandering, to have transparency about donors. Everywhere those ballot initiatives have occurred, they have won. So there is a real awakening going on now. And I think this COVID crisis is bringing it to the fore, because really this is a live, you know, real time natural experiment between two governing philosophies. And it's pretty clear which one is better for people and which one is quite literally deadly.
Well, the interesting thing, people were saying that Trump's basically created all the crises that in the administration. He created them himself, and then he sort of solves them, or he does something about a crisis that he's deliberately created, like with China and stuff. This is an actual real crisis. And they said, well, how is he going to, if he does this badly and he does this erratic and irrational stuff with crisis that he's created himself. He creates them and he tries to undo them and back and forth. What's he going to do if he gets a real crisis? And now we know, you know, he's just like a chicken with his head cut off.
Yeah, no, he has no clue about how to operate effectively in a moment like this and affect those things that are destructive. But again, I think, you know, going back to an earlier theme in our conversation, it's really important that people understand that Trump is the symptom of a much deeper problem. And a public health nurse who read Democracy in Chains wrote to me, and she said, I realize now that he is the tumor, not the cancer. And we have to have the diagnosis right to get the right treatment plan. So people need to understand that, too. Like, for example, with these reopen protests, you know, the usual suspects are out there in terms of these wealthy, you know, billionaire donors who are pushing organizations who are Americans for Prosperity, I just recently learned, was behind some of the litigation to take power away from governors, you know, that they're trying to use to keep people safe while they have the kind of street protests of, you know, many of these people who are armed and intimidating public officials and their fellow citizens. You know, this isn't coming out of thin air. This is a product of the kind of cause that I wrote about in the book. And so we have to realize that, you know, it's really important. The 2016 elections are probably the most important elections in our lives, in our lifetimes. And if the children of light lose this, I don't, you know, it could be gone forever, quite frankly, at this point. But that said, even if there is a kind of blue sweep in 2016, if we don't unrig the rules that the radical right has rigged against the people and against democracy, we're going to find ourselves back in the same situation in very short order.
That's
so
certainly something
so
I agree with.
So much deeper and wider than Trump.
The problem is that if there is a blue wave and Trump is defeated and we capture the Senate and stuff, a lot of the really evil, bad stuff will stop. But there's going to be a massive job of just undoing all the destruction he's wreaked in his 4 years in office. And in terms of the courts, it may be very, very long term. We don't know how bad the Supreme Court is going to be, how out of step it will going to be with the American people. It looks very bad from the outset. So even if he's defeated, we have a whole series of issues. So the best thing that you think if ordinary people should do is really get organized. And I know the virus has cut into all our the local people who are doing all the hard work of going door to door. That's all stopped. It's shut down political campaigns and stuff to a large degree, or reduced them to television and media. What should people do? I guess everyone should focus on what's most important to them, right? Because there's so much to be done, and so many races.
Yeah, I think that is really important. That I think, well, first of all, I think it's important that we help other people understand the nature of this cause and how strategically it's been working for decades now, and the kind of integrated apparatus it's built up. We need to know that, otherwise we're kind of shadow boxing. But I think if we can take that understanding then, as you say, into the arenas that perhaps we feel most passionate about or where we have the most to contribute, that is a good thing. Bring that understanding and then help all of us on, frankly, the sane side of American politics to get out of the silos, right? Or not to get out, but, we have to have, say, the environmentalists talking to the people who are defending Social Security and the post office, talking to the people who are protecting the schools from privatization, talking to the people who are dealing with civil rights abuses. So we've got to have more of a kind of integrated conversation on the progressive side. And it is encouraging that that's happening. Annie Leonard, who is the brilliant president of Greenpeace, now says, we've realized we will not get a healthy environment until we have a healthy democracy, right? It's that plain. And at Planned Parenthood, they're saying, we realize we won't be able to defend women's health and to ensure women's health until we have a healthy democracy. Folks in the labor movement are saying that. So I think there is this shared understanding, but then within that, people can plug in to maybe the groups that are most active or seem most effective where they are, or where they feel a special passion, or where they have a special knowledge or skill set. But the one thing I think your listeners might want to know, too, is that even though, you can't, have big street demonstrations now against the things that, you might have, 6 months ago, or, you can't go door to door, say, to canvas. There's still really important ways to be active. So, and to learn. So, for example, Greenpeace has these regular, Friday calls with Jane Fonda. I did one of these calls with her. It was great fun and really instructive. But they talk about the issues that are facing us, and people call in from not just around the country but around the world. Several thousand people are listening to these every Friday at I guess it would be 11 a.m. your time. So that's Greenpeace. The Sunrise Movement, which is the young climate activists, they're running essentially like online universities to teach people about organizing, to teach people about issues, involving the climate catastrophe, things that people need to know, Common Cause. All these other groups now are starting to do these online Zoom call webinar type things. And so if your listeners are feeling, if we all are, cabin fever, right, and they want to be able to do something, they should really check out some of these groups that they have, trust and have interest in, and see what they're doing, because there's just a whole lot of popular education and also online organizing.
Certainly
going on
in Sedona, the groups like After the March and the Indivisible groups and Emily's List group, all these people are doing Zoom conferences. And if you try it, folks, don't be too frustrated. The first time you try it, maybe some glitches and stuff, but it gets to be you get to, so you really kind of like the Zoom process. You're starting to send out emails.
Indivisible, because they're doing great stuff now, really creative new ways of organizing, and they, they really have a sense of what is needed to make change effective in any part of the country, depending on where you are. But they really, really know how to guide people in pressuring elected officials to do the right thing. So I think Indivisible, signing up for Indivisible would be a great, great way to get started.
And you're sending out, and I don't know how widely you want to do it, you're sending out newsletters essentially now, which talk about issues, but also usually you're recommending a book that you think is particularly excellent to people. Is that something you want to broaden, or is that something that's fairly narrow?
If people want to get on that list, they could just write to me. Actually, at nancy.mclean@duke.edu is my email.
Why don't you give it to us again, Nancy, slowly.
Okay, so it's Nancy, N-A-N-C-Y, dot McLean, M-A-C-L-E-A-N, at duke.edu, and then they should just say they want to be on that list. But, in fact, the next book that I was going to alert people to is right in front of me here, We Are Indivisible, A Blueprint for Democracy After Trump, and that is by the two co-founders of Indivisible. When Gary was talking about it, I thought, oh, yeah, I can't remember if Gary or Steve just mentioned Indivisible.
Are you working on any new books yourself?
I'm starting to think about a new one, but just kind of reading broadly now.
You've done a lot of good history work that someday I want to talk to you about when we don't have some kind of crisis going on. You've done an interesting book. I think it was your thesis on the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, how they presented themselves as the chivalrous Deep South.
Yes,
and they were really this brutal terrorist organization. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. And then you did work. Didn't you write on the importance of people organizing in terms of work?
Freedom Is Not Enough was that book, The Opening of the American Workplace. Yes.
And what was the main thesis of that? Was that that there's one thing to talk, there's one thing to do it, but if you have to work in the workplace, you have to connect to it?
So it was really about how important the struggle for access to good jobs was for all the movements for equality after World War II. So, of course, the Black Civil Rights Movement, but also the Mexican-American Civil Rights Movement, the women's movement. The book also looked at how conservatives essentially fought that from the get-go. There was no civil rights reform that they started, no measure to open up workplaces that they didn't oppose. So that's really what got me starting to track the modern conservative movement. And then from that, I found out about this libertarian substream, which, as I said before, you know, I think they're flying under a false flag and calling themselves conservative because they know that's where the votes are. But these people, these libertarians like Charles Koch, they are anything but conservative. They are radicals and revolutionaries, but of the right. And if they were to succeed, we would find our country unrecognizable.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. It's hard for me to see as an old guy that these are even resemble the conservatives that I grew up with, you know, in rural Oklahoma, who believed in traditional values and so forth. So there is some of that out there, but people and in those days, people who had a very fundamentalist or very ecstatic oriented religion were not right wing at all. They weren't politicized into this machine to elect people who are really not going to help them so much. How to put it gently, but I mean, I don't know the attraction of the libertarian rhetoric. To me, Nancy, what it's doing is it actually breaks down the connection with people. When I see them, what I see them doing is they're trying to break down workers' rights so that people can't organize as well. They're trying to break down this so that we're all atomized as individuals. And then the powerful individuals will control things completely, and the rest of us will have less and less say. If we can't organize and work together, if we can't have laws that control what happens in the workplace where they can just fire us for no reason.
Yeah.
You know, that's where concerns me, a lot. Uh-huh. And I think you're making a good point that Trump is, almost like an epiphenomenon of this, this conservative movement. They were the only person who would support him.
Yeah. And I think what you thought.
We're out of time. We're headed off air.
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZN. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.